vintage sand.
Hello, hello, hello. Here it is. It's a time for celebration. It's episode 50. Yeah! All right. John, you can turn the applause sign off. Thank you very much. It is Team Vintage Sand, and that would be inclusive. The legendary, well, introduce yourself to the nice people, both in person and our radio audience.
This is John Meyer. Hello, people.
And this is Michael Edman. Hello.
Just try to restrain the enthusiasm there, Mike. Whatever you can, you're at about a 9, I need you at about a 4. And I am Josh Cabot, and we are here to record, commemorate, and celebrate episode 50 of Vintage Sand, the film history podcast, your film history podcast, which began but 6 years ago as a little dream. Three old friends sitting in a Chinese restaurant that is no longer there, right?
And it's still empty, that space.
I know. We got it. Well, we have to open up something there.
New York.
Yep. But, and we said, well, I've known Michael for 40 years. And John for almost that long. John was my first roommate here when I came back to New York from grad school way back in 1987. Remember that? The good old days, kids, right? So we are just thrilled to be here and just beyond touched and thrilled that we've got about 25 of our nearest and dearest friends and family, et cetera, who've come to celebrate this with us. And I couldn't imagine a nicer thing in a better crowd. The whole premise of this is that we've never postured ourselves as experts, right? We are not experts on film. We are not frustrated filmmakers. We are not frustrated film critics. There's no such thing as a film critic anymore. It's really scary. If you go on the top critics on Rotten Tomatoes now, it's like some guy with a website.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're like, wow, what happened to film criticism? But we are just fans, and our goal, I'm a lifelong teacher, and we've got some of my favorite teachers here in the room with us, is just been to open doors, is just to open new possibilities and ideas, new paths, maybe films you haven't heard of or ways you've never thought about films before. And so here we sit in the 14th Street Y, you know, atop the fabulous Rainbow Room in Rockefeller Center, and we need a band to play us out, right? And now, the musical stylings of Tom Kaufman and his orchestra. We are here to celebrate episode 50, which is our sum up of 2023, and we call it Of Bombs and Bombshells, a sort of semi-clever twist on the Barbenheimer thing. And let's dive right in, guys. I mean, I think that this year has been kind of another difficult year to read. It's so hard to tell how this year is going to go down in history. Thoughts on 2023?
I thought it was a really good year.
I thought it was an excellent year. I've been keeping track of a lot of the movies I've seen, be it with AMC or with Screen Actors Guild screenings. And I came up with a list of 49 movies that I really liked.
Wow.
Yeah.
And see, and I kind of struggled to come up with 10 that I really, really loved. And John, what about you?
I have less than that I really love, but I do think it was a good year.
And
49 movies?
49
movies.
I haven't
heard. We're going to put them. We'll put it on.
You're not reading them tonight.
Wait, we'll put it on the website. We'll put it on the website, which is very cleverly called www.vintagesand.com. By the way, all right, extra bonus prize for anyone knows where the title of our podcast comes from. No cheating, Melissa. Oh, Kerry Cowan, of course, you overachiever. Go ahead.
Wait, it's Notorious.
That's right. You can't hear it over the sirens. They're coming to take everybody away. But yes, Kerry, it's the wine cellar in Notorious, right, where he knocks over the bottle and it breaks, and instead of wine being in it, it's uranium ore. And she says, "What was that?" And he says, "It was vintage sand." And so there we go. Vintage sand. So that's where it comes from. And, you know, let's begin by speculating about, as we always do, believing in my heart of hearts that the only test of art is time. What are the films from 2023 that you think are going to be watched, not necessarily in film class, but just in general, say 25, 50 years from now?
Killers of the Flower Moon.
Well, yeah, that's my favorite. not only is it my favorite film of last year, but it's my, I think one of the greatest films I've seen in the last 40 years.
Yeah,
I love that movie.
I can't argue with that.
Much.
It was beautifully done. And for more on that, please listen to episode 49, our previous episode, which is devoted entirely to said Scorsese epic. But I think Barbie's gonna have legs forever.
I really do. Too. I love the fact that a movie so strange made $1 billion. I just love it.
And a movie directed by...
It was so much fun.
Yeah.
It's just strange. But I did get a little tired of Pink by the end of the movie.
But it was so smart, too.
Yeah, very smart.
I mean, as I've said, my favorite line in the movies this year was Barbie's line about being a fascist. She's mm-hmm. like, I don't control the railroads or the means of economic distribution. How could I be a fascist? So I'm like, that in a film that's aimed towards... But that's the thing. It's 5-year-old girls will love it and 70-year-old film buffs will love it. I mean, she had me at 2001 at the opening.
Yeah.
You know, which is like shot for shot, frame for frame. And I was like, Greta Gerwig, I love you. And we have to consider the fact as to why all three of Greta Gerwig's directorial films have been nominated for Best Picture and she's never not been nominated for Best Director. But that's a whole other story.
You mean there's sexism in Hollywood?
Yeah, I know. Stunning, right? And so, anything, I think Oppenheimer's going to still be watched 50 years from now. We have some nods from the audience.
Because of the subject matter, yes. I don't know. One thing, Oppenheimer, I think, is really, really impressive technically. I'm drawn to it because of the subject matter, but at the same time, there's so many images, the way it's edited. It's almost over-edited. By the end of the movie, I felt a little numb.
And my objection to the film, as you guys remember originally, was that, 45 minutes before the end, you've got the Trinity test, which is this incredible sequence,
yeah.
And then the last 45 minutes is congressional hearings. I mean, I understand the connection, but I was like, oh, it's a bit of an anticlimax.
Yeah, it's like two movies put together.
It was, but it also was part of Oppenheimer's life, the
yes.
whole thing. And I understand why he did it. My problem with Oppenheimer is there was too much music.
Agreed.
Oh,
there
yeah.
There were times
yeah.
I couldn't hear the
yeah.
dialogue.
Gorenson.
And that's a
yep.
problem I have with
Nolan.
His films. I had that problem with Dunkirk, and I love Dunkirk.
Yep. Some mixing issues.
And
yeah, he always.
Killers of the Flower Moon, which I love the way the music was used.
Very spare. That beautiful Robbie Robertson
oh,
music,
my
definitely.
God. Wonderful music.
And I finally, today, this morning, got to see what may go down as the best film of the year 25 years from now, which is Ava DuVernay's Origin. And if you have, I'm just curious, has anyone seen it?
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, right. Because it was barely available. Yeah,
it played 1 week in Uptown at AMC to qualify for Oscars.
Which it didn't get any. I understand. How do you market that film? I mean, Michael, you always ask the question, who is this film for? I think it's for everybody, too. But it's the book is very challenging. And, I've never seen a film like, it's not a film about the book cast. It's about her writing the book. And her process, and it's kind of unique and heartbreaking and beautiful, and she's just amazing. I mean, she can do anything except children's fantasy. Wrinkle in Time was really a bit of a misstep, la 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 la, but we'll gloss over that. I mean, she did Selma. She did that brilliant TV series on the Central Park Five,
oh, yeah.
Yeah,
When They See Us,
that was great.
Which was, she did that incredible documentary 13th about the 13th Amendment. I mean, she can just do anything. So I think it's between her and Barry Jenkins as to who's going to be the first black person to win Best Director. All right, that's going to be a close, and no one, it's almost 100 years now, guys. No one black has won ever. Just saying. So
what other movies do you think, say, 20 years from now? I would say on Past Lives, I really stayed with me.
Oh, my God. Absolutely.
So beautiful.
Absolutely.
And at the end of that, I was a mess.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I absolutely. I think American Fiction.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Yeah.
I, no, okay. No, go ahead. This
well,
is, it's only interesting
I did,
when we argue.
I did like it. I saw it by myself on Christmas Eve. This is like the first Christmas Eve.
Don't say my boy Mike doesn't know how to party, all right?
I was by myself this particular Christmas Eve, and I went to see it expecting a far funnier movie. Mm. It was not that funny. It was actually very sad. I haven't have a problem with anything dealing with dementia.
Oh.
Well, do you feel the movie was marketed more as a comedy?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Right, yeah. How do you market that? And the and the endings? And I remember you didn't like the ending. Yeah.
Well, I thought it was precious. I overall liked the movie. I thought it was wonderfully acted. And that to me is, as a frustrated actor.
Mike's dream is to play Daffy Duck, by the way. That is his dream role.
He is one of my favorite. Him and Hedda Gabler.
In the same play.
Yeah. But
Meeting of the Minds.
But I thought it was beautifully acted. I just was a little disappointed in that. In the same way I was expecting The Holdovers to be far funnier than it was.
But
it
I
came
like,
out of that.
Oh, but I love The Holdovers.
It was beautiful.
I thought it was a very good movie, but I wanted to slash my wrist when I came out.
the ending. I know what you mean. The ending, though, does have a positive moment at the end, though. I mean, and he does something that's heroic.
Yeah, but I kept wondering what was going to happen to him in the
afterwards,
future.
Afterwards, but at the same time, you could make the point that perhaps it was a good thing for him because maybe he's going to actually take that next step and start writing that book he's been working on for 20-something years.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, let's face it. He was stuck at that place.
Oh, yeah, sure. That was his whole life.
Yeah.
I kind of thought he was going to win, and he didn't. Mm. Yeah. Well, all right. So let's use that as a convenient segue into the Oscars. So just, you know, on one level, I enjoyed the show. I liked everyone went back to sort of formal black, white, and silver, except all the women were dressed as mermaids. I didn't quite understand that, but there was Florence Pugh, so I was okay.
He's got a thing for Florence.
I have a slight Florence. Oh, yeah. I'm working on it, though. I'm genuinely working on it.
You need to see a therapist.
Yes, I think I'm right. We will do a drinking game, ultimately, where every time you hear me say Florence Pugh's name, you have to do a shot at home. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we'll so, all be wiped out, dead
exactly,
drunk.
Exactly,
hour.
Exactly. I thought the best line of the evening was just one word, was John Cena saying the word costumes. That was just beautiful.
That was very fun. No, it was overall was a good show, better than we've had the last few times. It still could have been shorter, but at the same time,
but it was the allotment. They fitted in what ABC had allotted.
Yeah, they could still start it even earlier. But the part that was absolutely horrible was the In Memoriam.
Oh my God. Get the necrology right. Michael does it 20 times better than everybody.
It was so disrespectful. And just stupid.
Yeah, last year, remember they did it with Lenny Kravitz playing and they cut it short to fit the Lenny Kravitz song?
Year,
I'm like,
this
no.
Year it was even worse this year.
Yeah, we were not happy. But fortunately, we've got Michael doing his necrology, so we will make up for that a little bit.
But I'm just Ken.
Yeah.
Best.
That was great.
I've been watching the Oscars. I remember when I was 7 years old, 72, Charlie Chaplin coming
on.
So that was the first one that I remember. And I think the I'm Just Ken number was maybe the single best dance number I've ever seen at the Oscars. General agreement and nodding of heads in the audience. Yeah, I mean, and then it didn't, I mean, I happen to be a Billie Eilish fan. I'm not really sure why, but I kind of love her. But she already had an Oscar. She's won it for the stupid Bond, you know, No Time to Die. And then how did they not give the Oscar to I'm Just Ken?
Just for that performance alone, it was.
Well,
it was,
but they vote before they see
it. I know.
Actually, they only allow, which I didn't know, they in the music branch for songs, they only allow two songs from a movie.
Oh.
So they could have actually nominated other songs from that film.
Well, listen,
yeah, I didn't know this.
I'm just happy because I've always been in the spring of 89, my friend's boyfriend worked at CBS Records and he brought home a tape for us. It was an actual tape, as in a cassette. It was 1989. And he said, you have to listen to this. This is the best folk music I've heard in 20 years. It was the Indigo Girls. And it was that first, and the album that opens with Closer to Fine. And so I was already flipped out enough about 2001 and that whole thing. But then they start playing Closer to Fine like five times in the movie. Like, I love this movie. I love you, Greta Gerwig. Yep. So yeah. But I totally agree with you, Mike, on Goranson winning the music for Oppenheimer. Something's up with the mixing.
I wasn't surprised though. And
no,
we
all predicted it, didn't we?
Right. Mm.
I think a lot of people are voting for those awards and they haven't seen the movie. And they're just voting for the music, not how the music is used in the movie.
It's like all the Brits who didn't know what the European Union was voting for Brexit. Just like that, in fact. Yeah. So
yeah. I mean, the music was good. It's just too much of it, and sometimes it was inappropriate.
Yeah.
It was drowning out the scene.
We took Sue to... hello, Sue. Wifey way in the back, to see Dunkirk, and she had to leave. First of all, because the accessible seating was in the front row. Imagine seeing Dunkirk in the front row. And literally, the sound was literally deafening. I don't know why Nolan does that, with the mixing. But
maybe he's hard of hearing.
No, but it only makes the dialogue that much harder to hear.
Everything he does is to level 11.
Right. I've been a fan since Memento. I thought Oppenheimer was great, and not just because I can't say her name is in it. I'm not even going to go there. And how did Barbie not win set decoration?
Yeah.
Well.
What?
Poor things won, right?
Sorry, young people, I'm so sorry, but everyone's like, oh, poor things, the whole steampunk thing is so original. Like, yes, unless you've ever heard of Terry Gilliam or, Junaid and Caro, who did, if you've never seen it from the 90s, City of Lost Children and Delicatessen are both gloriously licking films with that steampunk ethos. It's been done!
Well,
a lot of people don't know.
Yeah.
The kids today.
I mean,
I'm talking about people who voted me.
Cranky old people doing a podcast.
I mean, the visuals are very, very imaginative. It's almost like an art student on steroids. But by the end of the movie, it was numbing and it just at times just unpleasant to watch.
See, I guess I'm in the minority. I really liked Poor Things.
A lot of people did.
Very imaginative. I thought it was funny. It was an actual movie that advertised.
I know some people thought it was funny. I don't think I laughed.
It's not that easy to find. You're right.
I don't think I laughed once.
Yeah, well.
I love
we have some different senses of humor.
That I can avouch. I loved her performance. I mean, that's an impossible part to play.
Yeah,
and I've always kind of loved Emma Stone.
Yeah,
but
we all wanted
Lily Gladstone to
because
win.
We
but,
love.
But here's my problem with that. I think her performance is being trivialized because everyone's saying, oh, Oscars had this great moment to make a historical point, and honor Lily Gladstone.
Yeah.
But that just pushes her performance to the side and makes it a political thing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right? It was she's so quiet. And she says so little, and she owns that movie.
It's the kind of film acting that I love watching, where subtext and emotional life is so strong. She's able to dominate a scene without doing anything.
And they rarely give Oscars for that.
Yeah,
they tend to give it to the flashier performance. And I'm not
physical stuff.
Cutting down Emma Stone, I thought she was wonderful.
Brilliant.
It is a very flashy performance.
Yeah. Yes.
Can't believe she didn't win because she won every other award, didn't she?
She didn't win.
No, she didn't win the SAG award.
Oh,
the one I get to vote in.
And who did you vote for, Michael? Secret ballot.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, all right.
I voted for Lily Gladstone.
Yeah, I don't quite get that. But I mean, other good things. Wes Anderson won an Oscar. Yay!
Yay!
Finalmente! All right.
Am I the only one who did not like that movie?
We have another.
I liked bored.
Henry Sugar. I did.
I didn't care much for
it. I went to see all five films at IFC, and that was the last one, and I was like, can I stay awake?
The movie I thought should have won
was a film that Samantha Bee executive produced called Red, White, and Blue. It was not a comedy. Mm. It was about abortion. Brittany Snow played this mother of a young girl in Arkansas, and I don't want to say what happens in it, But I sobbed out loud. I was very embarrassed. I was just sobbing.
That was me at Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yeah, well, me too. But there were other people sobbing. I was the only one sobbing. So maybe everybody there was, I don't know. But I was so...
You're a sobber by nature. Yeah, I like that about you. True. I respect that about you.
That's true. I do cry easily.
Sentimental, aren't you? Yes and no, right?
But one I thought should have won for short. And the others I like more.
But I like
this one I just thought it was okay.
My daughter will be very happy to hear this. Aside from Grand Budapest, my favorite Wes Anderson film is Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Well, I like that
one. And so I think the mixture of Wes's sensibility and Roald Dahl works kind of well. So that worked for me. See, I didn't like Asteroid City.
I did.
I liked it, but I thought it may have worked better as a miniseries. There were so many characters.
Yeah, it was. I really wanted to like it too. Oh. But I like Wes in history. I like, you know, always talk about the fact that Quentin Tarantino's first five films take place roughly contemporary in something that feels like right now. And I love all five of them, especially Jackie Brown. But that's just a little plug. And then when he goes back into history. You know, to Nazi Germany, to slavery, to the Wild West and Hateful Eight, and then to his own childhood. I don't know. I just don't find the films as moving or as interesting. So, but with Wes, I kind of find his opposite. His you know, his contemporary stuff. I found kind of, here's a good English teacher adjective, twee. Yes,
but you don't
twee.
Like Royal Tenenbaums.
I like it, and I like Rushmore, and I do. I like them, but Grand Budapest just
grabbed
me.
I do like it a lot, but you don't like Grand Budapest. Because you thought, I remember you saying something about you thought it was cartoony.
Kind of.
Unhand my lobby boy.
Yeah.
I love that movie. But yeah, so, I mean, by the way, so I went and looked it up. Wes's first, you know PTA's never won one?
No, I knew that, yeah. That's why I think he won.
H-E-L-L, you know what, has Paul Thomas Anderson never won an Oscar?
No, he's up a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not getting that. And this is from the person whose favorite film of the teens was?
Phantom Thread.
Was Phantom Thread.
Great movie.
All right, yep. we have some applause from the Virginia side back there. All right, excellent. I was very happy about the fact that clearly they listened to our episode 48, which is about the history of labor unions and why there have been situations with workers and owners are so inherently dramatic. Why have there been so few great films about workers and labor unions and organizing? A few.
Because
Norma Rae.
Bomb at the box office.
Yeah, I guess. And also
Norma Rae didn't. Norma Rae was a very successful film.
Yes, yes, that I know.
But, I mean, you know, Mate One, I mean, which is so beautiful and just died on the vine with all of Johnson's
films.
Yeah, I know. By the way, guys, as I said on that podcast, check out a film called Salt of the Earth. From 1954. It's based on it's made by a bunch of people who had been blacklisted already, set out in New Mexico. It's the real story of a mining strike, and the men are forbidden from striking because one of the laws, and the women literally take over. They're mostly Mexican immigrants. They don't speak English, but the women take over and pick up the signs and keep the strike going. Not a big smash hit, as you might imagine, and no Hollywood money behind it at all, but it is findable. Check it out. Salt of the Earth, 1954.
Yeah, we argued about that because... And he agreed, too, about because of all the amateur actors kind of stuck out. And then you have
couple
a professional
of
actor, and it's like this conflicting style.
Will Gere is in
it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. And but otherwise thought any other thoughts on the show or on the awards?
Well, I was very, very happy to see Anatomy of a Fall win Best Original Screenplay. And I know you guys don't like it as much.
I'm going to give it another look because I know so many people think it's a really great movie. And I thought it was good. I wasn't crazy about it. I thought it was like all up in the head.
No, and also the big...
But she was great.
She's amazing.
She was great. The kid was great.
The dog was great.
And I love the dog.
Messi the dog was pretty awesome, too.
And I think that if France had submitted it as foreign film, I think it would have won over Zone of Interest. They submitted The Taste of Things, which I'm one of the few people who did not like the Taste of Things. Mm. And I love Juliette Binoche, and I love food.
But, not necessarily in that order, but...
Yeah. But I was very disappointed in that.
I just finally got to see Zone of Interest. I don't know. I still don't know.
I found that the... I think it's really good. I think it's an excellent movie. I think it's really done well. It's excruciating to watch.
Deliberately, I think.
But I also found that it stayed with me. I kept thinking about it for almost a whole week afterwards. I know that you said
you was bored.
You were, because you said you thought it was.
And I saw
it. So
I
the
think
Holocaust
that,
is
I
boring.
Think that,
no.
I think also,
no.
But I think also a lot of people start watching that movie, and after a half hour, I agree with you. You get the point.
You get the point.
But at the same time, I think it's just natural for people to just shut down watching that movie.
Yeah.
I mean,
I saw it actually the night before it opened. I went to the AMC. They mm-hmm. have Thursday night screenings. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, there's something wrong with me. I'm obviously a Nazi or because I'm finding this movie dull. I'm not from about Auschwitz. And then I got home and I read what's her name's review in the Times.
Manila Dargis. She said it was vacuous, which I wouldn't go
that far.
I disagree.
But a lot of critics loved it too. Mm-hmm. Did you read about how it was made? It's really interesting. Mm-hmm. They set up cameras everywhere, all over the place. They had the scene set up, and then the director and cinematographer left. And all the actors just did what they did, and then came, and then, you know, they put it all together. And the sound,
yes.
The use of sound,
that's what's
going to
that's what's going to stay with me.
Also, the scenes with the little girl, the girl who on the bicycle who's planting food all over the place,
that's
based on a real person.
But why did he have to do it in that almost negative kind of heat thermal?
I think the idea was so that you didn't know who it was. I'm not exactly sure. Also, maybe it was just to give a break from the visuals. We'll have to talk to the director.
We'll get Jonathan Glazer in here and talk to him about
it. Let's invite him to the podcast.
Well, yeah, I mean, because his last film was almost 10 years ago, was Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson, and I liked that, but I didn't quite get what the big deal was about it. So, but the soundscape of this film, it reminded me in the weirdest way of Eraserhead. In Eraserhead, there's always this sort of industrial noise happening in the background, and because you're in some kind of steel mill town, somewhere probably in Pennsylvania. Here, you have that same low hum in the background, and every so often you realize what that is, what's going on.
Yeah.
And that was, for me, that was very powerful.
Yes.
But then, why does he cut, sorry guys, spoiler alert, why does he cut to the present day and they're in the museum?
I don't know.
What was
the
point?
Only thing I think of, and I didn't really like that, is maybe to show that it's become so sterile now? I don't know.
I don't know.
I actually, because that last, say, quarter of the movie is where I thought it kind of veered off, because it started to become more literal.
Right, and he, the Commandant Hess, who we followed all the way through, we see him once he's being sent back to Auschwitz because the Hungarian Jews are going to be deported, so it's 700,000 new people coming into Auschwitz. It's 1944.
My wife was very happy
that
they could stay there.
Right, no, but then he throws up.
Well,
what are we supposed to? Are we supposed to?
I saw that as they were all getting sick on the ash that was in the air.
So
yeah, that's what I thought.
Okay, so you didn't feel like it was like
the
emotion because the mother-in-law leaves.
Yeah, I think she's the only one
because
who had any emotion.
Because she was confronted with what was really going on. She was like, I've got to get out of here.
But I fundamentally agree with you guys in that, you know, you could reread the Hannah Arendt article on the banality of evil and all of that, and you sort of get the idea.
Yeah.
I mean, that people, I'm sure you've all often thought to yourselves or occasionally thought to yourselves, you know, how does someone participate in something like that during the day? And then just, you know, punch out, go home to dinner, you know, read the paper, put your feet up, play with the kids, you know.
That's
and
what
then,
they were doing. And also you had that scene, too, with the... the people who were designing the crematorium.
Oh, my God.
And
yeah,
you get the point that there were a lot of people who were collaborating with Nazis for money.
Yeah.
It's all it was about.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
I should add that the five movies nominated for international film, for the most part, were not a happy bunch. I mean, they
they rarely are.
One from Italy, Il Capitano, oh my God. I mean, it was good, But these two teenagers coming in from north of Africa trying to get to France, going through hell, and it was just, it was excruciating. It's like, oh. And then, and then what was it? There was another one. Well, the one I liked the most was Wim Wenders' Perfect Days.
Which was, he did in Japan, right?
He did in Japan, and it's a true love letter to Tokyo. It made me want to get on a flight there. It's a wonderful movie.
Nice.
Please see it.
Well, we're friends.
And then there were two, oh, the one, of course, Society of Snow, which is, we all know, it's just what we need, another
Cannibalism.
Ethan Hawke, a remake from an old Ethan Hawke movie.
So, 20 years from now, would we still be arguing about Zone of Interest?
I think it's going to last.
Yeah,
I think it's going to have legs. I do. I don't. I only think there's one truly great fictional film made about the Holocaust, and it's not Schindler's List, which is really earnest and well-meaning and beautifully done. But
which one?
Pianist.
Yeah. Okay.
Because The Pianist feels like it was made by somebody who was there. And he was, you know, Spielberg has all the greatest intent, love, I mean, the acting in Schindler's, Schindler's List is just a beautifully made movie. But The Pianist felt real to me. Much as we are not friends of Roman Polanski on the podcast, okay, just want to get that out of the way.
Apples and oranges, one is like the big picture of what was going on and everything, mm-hmm. and then one is centering on one person and the trials he goes through. I like the pianist a lot.
And pianist has, except for, I'm sorry to say again, I'm being politically incorrect today, except for the crane shot in Gone with the Wind, where the camera keeps going up, 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 up at the train station, and you see thousands and thousands of the wounded with the tattered Confederate flag. Not such a bad thing. At the end, the crane shot in The Pianist, where he's been stuck in that room for like 4 years, and then he gets out, and Polanski lifts the camera up, and just the endless devastation that was once a city is now just rubble forever and ever. I love that.
Also, the fifth nominee I just remembered was The Teacher's Lounge.
Oh, yeah, I didn't see it.
Abbott Elementary without humor.
Oh.
And I liked it. It's a good movie. Please don't see it.
But please watch Abbott Elementary, though.
It'll discourage you from wanting to teach. Because it's such a downer.
I'm just curious. My teacher people here, do you guys watch Abbott? Carrie, kind of. Tom, no?
I mean, I've seen it a little bit.
It is the only thing I've ever seen that really captures what it feels like to be a day-to-day public school teacher, I think. So then,
I'm interested to know your feelings about The Holdovers.
Well, that's...
It's a private school. It's...
Well, I'm not a big Alexander Payne fan.
I'm not either.
But I really liked it. It surprised me a lot. I love the woman who won supporting actress, Divine.
She's very good.
Yeah, she's great. And
she was great. No, I love The Holdovers.
Another sad character.
Yeah.
I still don't know how critics call it a comedy. I just...
Critics? What critics?
Oh, God, It was advertised. It was marketed as a comedy.
I know, it was marketed as sort of a comedy.
Reviews?
It's a laugh riot.
There's a few moments of humor, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I also want to get in is that I have been, since Poison... a huge Todd Haynes fan.
Oh, yeah.
And his last couple have been... He did the Velvet Underground documentary, which was good, and he did...
Safe?
Wonderstruck. No, I'm talking about the last couple. And Wonderstruck was lovely, but not... And boy, is May December good.
I love it.
I don't understand why that was...
Most people I know don't like it.
I didn't care much for it. By the end of the movie, I was like, I don't care.
The only thing that took me out of the movie, and I don't understand why he did it, was why he lifted the score from the 1971 Go-Between, which
only you would recognize, of course.
Because of Julie Christie.
Yeah.
And,
the Julie Christie fan club.
Right. In the analogy department, Michael is to Julie Christie as Josh is to Florence Pugh. So, there you go.
She's a little older.
Just a little. All right.
But... It took me out of the movie because it's like, I remembered this score so well, and that's one of Joseph Losey's most successful films. But I just don't understand why he did it.
So you guys did not like... I thought the end of May, December...
No.
Natalie Portman doing the monologue mm-hmm. as Julianne Moore, I thought was just riveting.
And
totally.
The husband.
Creepy, yeah, very creepy.
And the husband, what's his name?
How did he not get nominated?
He got the New York Film Critics Award. And
right,
didn't even get nominated.
No,
so I thought that was a very... At least it got a screenplay nomination.
I'm a Haynes fan. I think I don't think it's up there with Safe or with Velvet Goldmine or with Carol especially, which I think is his masterpiece.
I love Far From Heaven.
God, he's amazing. We love Todd Haynes. And I even like the Dylan one. I'm like the only one.
Oh, I liked it.
Yeah, I'm not there. I thought that was really
interesting.
Yeah,
interesting.
I was thinking about it last night. We went to see a production of Pericles, Fiasco's Pericles.
How is that?
And it's good, except they have five different people playing Pericles. For no apparent reason. All right? And I don't really know why. And I felt that way. But you see what he was doing with the Dylan thing, having six different people play Dylan.
I thought it was very ingenious.
Yeah. I liked May, December, and I'm sticking by that. All right, so anything else about the... thank you, John. I feel better now. Aside from the fact that we really need John Mulaney to host next year, any other thoughts on the Oscars themselves?
Make it shorter.
I read that we were talking about when Al Pacino presented the Best Picture. He claims he was told by producers to mention...
I read that.
He was told by Warren,
the nominated,
and Faye Dunaway,
but not De Niro in the wings to just say the Colors of the Flower Moon,
but not to mention the nominated films because they had already been introduced individually, and the same thing with the Best Song nominees because when the Best Song was announced, they didn't like.
Yeah, it was still very awkward.
Yeah, I thought it was wrong. I mean, this is supposed to be about the movies.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and this is one of the reasons why I, for the last 10 years, really protested the fact that they don't give the honorary Oscars.
Yeah,
I know it would make it longer, but some of the most beautiful moments of people winning honorary Oscars that I've ever seen. I remember when Stanley Donen got an honorary Oscar, and Deborah Carr, and all these wonderful
people. Fellini won.
And the Fellini. Yeah. Oh, I still cry when I think of it. And
he's an easy crier for a Nazi.
I am.
For a curmudgeon.
For a curmudgeonly Nazi, which is the worst kind. Right? So, yeah, absolutely.
Were we going to talk about our five favorite
films
of the year? Because mine have no relation to the Oscars.
Go for it, Mike. Kick it off.
Okay. As I said, I had 49 films, and I had a 10 best list. I'm not going to relate it, but there were six of the films on my 10 best list that didn't get a single Oscar nomination. One of them is Saltburn, which I'm not going to talk about because I know a lot of people hate it.
Lots of people hate it.
I liked it. I couldn't remember after the first time I saw it, I thought, do I like this movie or not? And then I went to see it again and I decided I liked it. But there are five films, some of whom you may not have ever even heard of, that I really, really liked.
That's good. That's what we do here.
Talk about it in order of when I saw them. One is called After Love. You saw it? Really?
I heard of it.
Oh, because nobody else.
No, we'll take that. He was so excited. You got his hopes up.
Yeah. Oh.
You were that other person there.
It was actually made in 2020, and it didn't open commercially here until January at the Angelica. But it was written and directed by Aleem Khan, his first film. It stars Joanna Scanlon as a British woman who converted to Islam and to her husband, with her husband. And her husband's sudden death, she discovers that he had another family. So she goes to France and becomes a cleaning woman to the other woman and teenage son, who know nothing about the man's death. It sounds like a dopey comedy. It's not. It's very, very moving. Joanna Scanlon, apparently, I've seen her in small parts. She was in Kinky Boots, Notes on a Scandal, and I think she does a lot of sitcoms in England. She's known for doing comedy. This was a dramatic role. She's wonderful. She won the BAFTA Award in 2022, I think. It took forever for this film to get released. And it's available on Prime Video for $1.99. Second film, and I know two people here who definitely saw it, is A Fire, which I love. German film written and directed by Christian Pezoid. Two 20-something male friends are traveling to a summer house near the Baltic Sea, one to finish his book and the other to finish a photographic portfolio. And when they get there, they discover that a young woman is also staying there. A male lifeguard joins the trio, and complications occur. This, by the director's own acknowledgement, is definitely influenced by the work of Eric Rohmer.
Okay.
But despite the comedy, there is a tragedy lurking, and it won the Silver Bear Award at the Berlin Festival. I only saw it once. I really want to see it again. It's available on Prime for $5.99. This is why I don't get Prime, because I resent the fact that you have to pay to see these films. The third one is called Fallen Leaves, a Finnish film written and directed by Eri Kuras.
Oh, Kurismaki.
You know?
Yeah, love him.
I've seen that one.
It's a rom-com, but it's... It's about two Helsinki loners who fall in love through karaoke, being fired from menial jobs, and adopting a stray dog. And they somehow fall in love. It is perhaps the driest romantic comedy I've ever seen.
Yeah, well, when you think Finland, you think comedy.
Yeah. I'm watching this thinking, I read a review saying it was a comedy, and the comedy sneaks up on you. It won the National Society of Film Critics Award for Best International Film, and it was shortlisted for the Oscar. And I guess it was too much humor. They didn't want to see it. But I Prime Video again, $4.99. Eileen, directed by William Olroyd, director of Lady Macbeth. I take it you've seen that.
No, I have not.
That introduced Florence Pugh.
Oh, that Lady Macbeth. Okay, all right.
You haven't seen it? You have seen it? No?
I don't think... No, I've been thinking of the Cohen, Denzel...
No. Well, I hear it. I want to see it because this is the first time I've seen work by this man. It's a news... And it's New Zealand actress Thomasin McKenzie.
Oh, from Leave No Trace.
Plays a young woman living with her widowed alcoholic father in a small Massachusetts town in 1964. She works in a male juvenile prison, unhappily, until she strikes up a friendship with a newly hired psychologist, beautifully played by Anne Hathaway. Woo-hoo. She is so good in this. This is a psychosexual thriller that one critic described as a Todd Haynes film filtered through the lens of a Hitchcockian tale. And half of it takes place on Christmas Eve. It's become one of my favorite Christmas movies.
See, I'll stick with Die Hard. Thank you.
Along with The Ref. And I've become a real fan of Anne Hathaway this year because she was in another film called She Came to Me, opposite Peter Dinklage, and Marissa Tomei.
Right.
Wonderful film. Rebecca Miller directed it. And... as I said, it's one of my 49 films that I managed to see this year. Once again, Eileen is also available on Prime Video for $5.99. The fifth film, people might be more known about this or familiar, All of Us Strangers. It's written and directed by Andrew Haigh, who directed one of my favorite films of the last decade, 45 years, with Charlotte Rampling.
And who you've mentioned several times.
Yeah, I really, really like him. He's also directed Weekend, and he was the showrunner for Looking for HBO. It is basically a gay love story and a ghost story it's beautifully told. It's extremely intense, and it's basically just four characters in the whole film. Wonderfully acted by Andrew Scott, who is my favorite actor working today.
Talking about Moriarty here.
Yeah. So. And he's also the hot priest in Fleabag.
Yeah.
And Paul Mescal as the couple, and Jamie Bell and Claire Foy as Scott's dead parents. And this one got some notoriety. It did win the LA Film Critics Award for Best Screenplay, and it won the National Society of Film Critics Award for Andrew Scott, but it didn't win a single Oscar nomination.
Nope.
And it did do good business. This one is available on Hulu. You don't have to get at it on Prime.
I think like your list kind of goes to that moment in the Oscars when the winner for screenplay for American Fiction was talking about
yes.
make more movies for less money
yes.
instead
right.
of spending so much money on the bleak,
yes.
big
$300 million on the Flash, guys. Come on, that was worth it, right?
But these are wonderful movies, and people don't know, except for maybe all of us strangers. People don't really know about these films, and I think it's a shame.
Well, I'm just going to be very quick because we've talked about almost everything I have. I just
yeah.
have just a couple of notes. This is the year of Ayo Edebiri, you know, between The Bear, and which she's just genius on, and Bottoms, which I thought was, which my daughter back there tried to warn me off of, and I thought it was one of the funniest things I've seen this year.
Great
loved
movie.
It. Loved it. Loved it. Loved it. Loved
hilarious
it.
Movie.
I absolutely loved it. So Bottoms is my number 10, actually. Then Zone of Interest is 9. Holdovers is 8. Past Lives, I agree with everything said up here. It's just glorious and romantic and beautiful and the best. In the best possible way, and directed by a new woman director, yes, Celine Song. So hopefully another new voice. Number 6, May December, I'm sticking by that, sorry. Number 5, Origin. I don't know what to make of Origin yet. I need to see it about 8 more times. I mean, I read cast, and I didn't really understand. Not. It's one of those things where it's the last year at Marienbad thing. It's like, I don't know if you guys have ever seen that, but there's something happening there, and I couldn't figure out what it was, but I felt like I was really missing something. I felt that way about The Master, too, Paul Thomas Anderson's film, The Master. I was like,
yeah.
something interesting is happening here, and I'm missing it. So there's that. Origin is dead. I would say maybe the most ambitious film of the century so far and what she's trying to do there. It's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, wow. So that's number of American Fiction at 4, Killers of the Flower Moon at 3, Oppenheimer at 2, and yeah, Barbie at 1. Absolutely. 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 I stand by it. I think that is, I don't think anything is going to change about that. I thought one good thing about movies last year was, like, all of my favorite directors put out bombs. Aronofsky did The Whale, and Chazelle did Babylon, and it was just like one 3.5-hour disaster after another. So, I mean, and Iñárritu did Bardo, and oh my God, it was just miserable. So, at least there was not, I mean, my best movie-going experience is this year. I just went to see Pi. Village East Cinema just showed Pi on March 14th on 314. I hadn't seen it on a big screen since 98 when it came out. It reminds me why I love Darren Aronofsky so much in spite of The Whale, which was so freaking horrible. And, didn't much like it.
It's a decent play.
Saw we go upstate to the Adirondacks in a small town called Screen Lake, and they have a beautiful old Art Deco theater there, and they show one silent movie every summer, and they have a live piano accompaniment, and it's the 100th anniversary of Harold Lloyd's Safety Last.
Wow.
So I went to see that with live piano. That was amazing. Carrie and I went to see The Birds on a big screen. I hadn't seen The Birds on a big screen. Oh, my goodness.
I saw that when I was 8 on the big screen, and to this day.
And it hasn't impacted him psychologically at all.
To this day, I see a flock of birds and I get nervous.
Yeah, well,
I was too young.
Mike's the guy who was taken to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf when he was 11.
I like that one.
See? So
I mean, it was like Thanksgiving.
I rest my case.
I love The Birds. I think it's one of his best movies.
It's funny. When I saw The Birds for the first time, I thought there was a reel missing at the end. I was like, wait, what? What happens? How do you do that? I actually went to the guy. I said, is there a reel missing or something? I was like, I need to know what happens at the end. And then it keeps rising and rising and rising on my Hitchcock list because
yeah.
it's just the whole universe, the whole Hitchcock theme in one beautiful little movie. So, and yeah, going to see both Barbie and even the awful Indiana Jones film at the drive-in. We got to see it at the drive-in up in Lake George, New York. So seeing anything. We even saw, like, you know, Black Widow. And, you know, what was that awful one? Was that action film with Charlize Theron, the futuristic one?
That was on Netflix?
No. Atomic Blonde, thank you, daughter. And I think the fifth Mission Impossible film, Ghost Protocol, whatever it was, which was fine. Seeing anything at a drive-in makes it good. It's like going to a ball game. Food you would never eat on a dare. You know, at a ball game, you're like, hey, this is not bad.
So, I remember when I moved to Minnesota, one of the most bizarre double feature drive-in things I ever saw were Frenzy and Women in Love.
Wow. Wow. That's
that was weird.
That is a
someone with a very strange sense of humor.
Yeah. And it was in Duluth. It's a small town in Duluth.
And my last one, and I got to see Pandora's Box at Film Forum.
I wanted to.
Restored.
I
the last great silent film.
I've only seen
and
it on TV.
The glorious Louise Brooks. Even on a small screen at home. It's on DVD. I cannot recommend that enough. I just love it. So, yeah, so there were a lot of good movie experience. I don't have 40, how many of you?
49
of them.
But I did want to mention one other film.
No.
The 10
no,
best
that's
films.
It. You're done.
No. One, because you two hate it. And I'm guessing that everybody doesn't like it, but it was on my 10 best. It was nominated for Oscars and lost them all. And that was Maestro.
Yeah.
I liked it a lot.
Nope.
That's a movie I really wanted to see because of the subject matter.
Really wanted to.
My feeling during the movie was I really admired all the work and research that went into doing that, but I just kept seeing a lot of work. And by the end of the movie, I felt distanced because I kept seeing the work, especially with Bradley Cooper.
I thought he was excellent.
Screenplay just, I thought, was terrible. Like, did someone write this and get paid cash American money for writing it? Well, time will tell. That's a beautiful thing.
Right. I saw the film twice, and the first time I saw it was at a SAG screening with someone, and she told me when she saw it on Netflix that it lost a lot of its impact on TV.
I don't think she liked it then, and she did not like it on Netflix. I don't think that's the reason
I didn't care for it. But I was very...
There are good scenes. There were some scenes I felt like I was in an acting class.
Watching
an expense.
And how did you do it?
Watching someone doing an exercise. I don't know.
I liked his Star is Born. I thought it was the best of the four.
Yeah, I didn't. Well, that's not saying much.
And I'm probably not going to be alive for the next one.
John, I think he should be in the next one.
Exactly. John?
Oh, well, I don't have a full 10. So Zone of Interest, Oppenheimer, Barbie, American Fiction, Past Lives, The Holdovers, and Killers of the Flower Moon.
In ascending order, that's
yes,
what I want.
Yes, okay. And I have to say, I mean, by far my three favorite are Killers of the Flower Moon, The Holdovers, and Past Lives. And both Killers of the Flower Moon and Past Lives just affected me so much emotionally. Yep. And I haven't felt that way going to see a movie, especially Killers of the Flower Moon, in a long, long time. Because I purposely saw that by myself early on a Sunday partly because of the length and also just because of my work schedule lately. And having read the book, I already was very familiar with what it was going to be about, and I knew it was going to get to me. I purposely went by myself, because at the end, I just sat there for almost 10 minutes. I was crying for the longest time. And especially a Scorsese movie, I can't think of any Scorsese movie that got to me so much emotionally.
Well, yeah. And as we talked about in the episode that we did on Killers of the Flower Moon, it's the one time he doesn't stylize the violence.
Yeah, at all.
So matter of fact, it's so brutal and blunt. You know, people just walk up and shoot each other.
And that's what was made it so impactful.
Yeah. Right.
Agreed.
Made it so real. It made me think of Open City.
Yes, good.
There's that part at the end when they kill the priest.
They execute the priest.
And it's done so simply and just matter of factly, and it's like, oh, the shock of it.
No, I totally agree. I
wanted it to be longer. I thought I would have.
Yeah, we voted for a miniseries.
A miniseries, like 5 episodes.
Yep. But I'm glad it was made into a film because, once again, I'd rather watch things at a theater.
Right.
Than on a small
screen. That's our message to everybody here and at home.
I get it.
The Frances McDormand message. Watch that. My favorite moment in all film was when DiCaprio testifies and comes clean and he says, "I'm clean, I purified my soul, I confessed,
yeah.
I feel like a weight's lifted off my shoulders," and she just looks at him and says, "What did you give me?"
Yeah.
And he's like, "What are you talking about? I gave you insulin." She's like,
"That's it.
What did you give me?" And there was so much power in that. The ability, and that is, as you guys pointed out in the episode that we did on Killers of the Flower Moon, that's the scary thing about both De Niro and DiCaprio's characters, is that they are able to carry such hate and such love. I mean, when John Lithgow is questioning him, and, you know, did you marry Molly because, you know, you got the head rights and the rights of the land? And he looks at it, he's like, no. No. She rode in my cab. We fell in love. He genuinely loved her and genuinely participated in the willing destruction of everyone and everything she loved. How do you hold those two ideas? At the end, you know, you get the sense that De Niro really believes that the Osage love him, that he is beloved by the Osage.
I was listening to an interview with De Niro, and he talked, you know, getting De Niro to talk to begin with is always a task, but
it's cutting down Trump.
And he said, "I played him as a nice guy."
Mm-hmm. And that's the way to play a villain.
As someone who believed that he was a nice guy.
Yep.
Because there's so many actors using TV. They twirl the mustache.
Yeah.
And it drives me nuts. And if I were teaching an acting class and I had a chapter on villains, I would say, got to see Killers of the Flower Moon to watch what De Niro does.
Yeah.
Yep, 100%, absolutely. All right, so let's close the main body of things with your favorite film author and one of mine, Mark Harris, wrote an article last week in the New York Times about how, you know, with streaming up in the air, everything's up in the air, AI and the strikes and everything. This feels like the end of something. And Mark Harris says, and he wrote that brilliant book about the 5 films from 1967, Pictures of a Revolution, which you haven't read, I really recommend.
Yeah, it's a great book.
Brilliant. And also the Mike Nichols thing.
Which has been an option for a movie.
Oh, God.
How are they going to make a movie out of that?
Well, what it said was they were going to go up to from his childhood, from when he came here, up until his first film.
No.
I don't know.
Bad. So, bad idea. Anyone want to invest in that one, by the way? We're taking numbers at the end. But at the end of the article, Harris says, this may be a good thing. In other words, we may be in 1969. And in 1969, the original incarnation of Hollywood collapsed on itself. You know, they were turning out Paint Your Wagon and these big lavish musicals, Dr. Doolittle, that no one was going to see. Meanwhile, Easy Rider, which cost like $750,000 to make, made $30 million. And they were like, okay, we have no idea what's going on. The studios all got bought up, but
they were trying to compete with TV.
But then all of a sudden they were like, let's give the kids a chance. And so Scorsese and De Palma and Lucas and Spielberg and Coppola all got the chance to direct. So my question to you guys is this 1969? In other words, it feels like the end of something. Are you optimistic that something great and new may be born from it?
I'm not sure if it's going to be new, but I'm optimistic just because I think there are so many good movies out there. They're small, some of them. Some of them were big. I love Ben Affleck's Air, for instance.
I thought that was so freaking
entertaining, and I'm not a sports fan in the least.
It's not about sports.
Well, it's about marketing of sports, with the shoe and everything. I thought, oh my God, this is really entertaining. And unfortunately, it was, produced by Prime, and it didn't have much of a theatrical showing.
No.
And I thought that was too bad.
Yeah.
Because I think
it's fun. It's well acted. I just kind of, at the end of it, I was just kind of like, okay, it's about marketing.
But I mean, that's an example of a mainstream movie, and then there's a lot of movies that
Well, there's a lot more opportunity now for independent filmmakers than there used to be.
And that's
a great thing.
I think that's great. And I think it'll continue as long as there are people, especially young people, who are willing to go out and see these movies and watch them on TV. I don't mean to be prejudiced against TV watchers.
Yes, he does, folks. Yes, he does. But
the viewing experience has changed.
No.
And I think movies now are understanding that better.
Oh, sure.
But also, because of streaming areas like Netflix or whatever, and Apple TV, Scorsese would be able to make Killers of the Flower Moon or The Irishman. So
that's wonderful.
Right. That's right.
That's true. No, I give you that.
On the other hand, I went to see Zone of Interest down at the Regal at Essex Street. The ticket was $19. This is, by the way, the middle of the day on a weekday. $19. I got a small popcorn and a small soda. That was another $19.
Yeah.
So I paid $38 to see.
But I belong to the AMC, which gives you $29 for three films
a
week.
That's why it's like 500 movies a year.
Yes. And also what I get from the Screen Actors Guild.
And, the theater-going experience kind of does have to change. But
it's got to be cheaper. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, if you were taking your family to go see, the Spider-Man film, that's 150 bucks there, easy.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but I'm always optimistic. I always feel like there's the next wave. It's always nothing new is ever going to happen, and then it's 1989, and you get Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and then Tarantino shows up, and Haynes, and all this wave of independent filmies, and then they all get bought by Disney, and that dies, and so then it's
I think it's going to continue
cycle,
though.
Is Tarantino really going to retire?
He says he is.
Yeah, so did Soderbergh. Look how well that worked out. All right, so we move to America's second favorite part of the podcast, and we're going to prove to you how bad the Oscars were at doing it. We're going to hand over the necrology piece, a shortened necrology piece, because we haven't met in 3 months, so a lot of great folks have passed on in that time. So Mike is going to do his necrology and do it right. So listen up, Hollywood.
Okay, I just have six... artist who have died in the last 3 months that I feel are really belong in there. And I believe the Academy had like four of them up there. Tom Wilkinson, 75. This one.
We know you're
right after.
Yeah, but he died so suddenly too, And 75 is young. British stage, TV, and film actor. He trained at the Royal Academy of London, and he appeared in small roles in the 80s and early 90s, including Weatherby, Sense and Sensibility, In the Name of the Father, and Priest. He gained notoriety, though, for his performance as the aging ex-foreman who joins other unemployed steelworkers, and they scheme to make some money by having a striptease act in the Full Monty, and he received the BAFTA Award for Best Supporting Actor. His roles continued to get larger. Oscar Wilde, as the Marquess of Queensberry, Oscar and Lucinda, Shakespeare in Love as the cold landlord who turned into a theater-loving bit player, Rush Hour, The Patriot, among others. In 2001, he appeared as the father of a slain son in Todd Field's In the Bedroom, which won him his first Academy Award nomination and the New York Film Critics Award for Best Actor. Other notable films in that decade include The Importance of Being Earnest, Girl with a Pearl Earring, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, great movie, Stage Beauty, Batman Begins, Woody Allen's Cassandra's Dream, and as a corporate lawyer who has a breakdown in Tony Gilroy's Michael Clayton, which brought him his second Academy Award nomination, this time as Best Supporting Actor. He was very believable playing Americans on TV. He played Benjamin Franklin on HBO's John Adams, Joseph P. Kennedy in the TV series The Kennedys, and President Lyndon B. Johnson in Ava DuVernay's Selma.
Yeah.
When preparing to make his leap into Hollywood films in the late 90s, he said that nothing could be as frightening as stripping in front of 200 women in the Full Monty. Any comments?
Love him.
I love him.
Could do anything. Anything.
Yeah. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, I never saw him give a bad performance.
As the saying goes, I watch him read the phone book.
Yeah, I believed him as an Italian gangster in Batman Begins. I mean, that's like almost impossible.
Yeah. Great.
And very, very versatile. Could play the really good guy or the bad guy.
And a great loss. Herman Rauscher, 95, playwright and screenwriter. Rauscher wrote for ad agencies in the 1950s and 1960s, and also for TV anthology programs such as The Ecola Hour and The Goodyear Playhouse. He had one Broadway play in 1962 called Harold with Anthony Perkins, but it closed after 20 performances. However, he was able to adapt an unproduced play called Sweet November into a successful film with Sandy Dennis and Anthony Newley. He then collaborated with Newley on the script Can Harmonious Merkin Ever Forget Mercy Hump and Find True Happiness? Did you see that?
I have seen
God, that. God, that's awful.
Bad mid-British 60s.
Oh,
really
my
bad.
God, it was bad.
Mid-60s British film.
And Newley was also the star and director, and it was a notorious failure and pretty much ended his film career, I think.
Who, Newley? Or
Anthony Newley, yeah.
Well, there's a mercy somewhere.
Rauscher's next film was Watermelon Man, directed by Melvin Van Peebles,
right,
about a bigoted white insurance salesman who turned black overnight. At the time, it wasn't
so
considered
stupid
a success. Rauscher claimed in an interview that Van Peebles made it more of a black power film than he intended, but the film has grown in stature
very much
over the years. Rauscher's next film was by far his most successful, Summer of 42. It's based on his sexual encounter at 14 with a war widow in Nantucket. He had submitted the script 49 times before Warner Brothers acquired it in 1970. The studio did request that he up the age to 15.
Oh, so they did a Lolita on it. Reverse Lolita.
Yeah.
All right, nice.
Robert Mulligan directed it, and it was an enormous hit. It was the fifth highest grossing film in 1971, and it won Rauscher an Oscar nomination for Best Original Screenplay. Now, in the film, the widow leaves the island after the encounter and writes him a farewell note, which Rauscher claimed actually happened. After the film's release, Rauscher received a letter with no return address from a woman in Ohio who he believed was the widow.
Wow.
She wrote that the ghost of that time would be better left alone.
Ooh.
So she was not too happy.
Not happy.
Wow.
Rauscher wrote a sequel to the film 2 years later, The Class of 44, which was not successful. Then he also wrote Ode to Billy Joe, based on the Bobby Gentry song of the same name, and that, which was not very good. And an adaptation of Sidney Sheldon's The Other Side of Midnight, which was successful. He wrote three novels. I didn't like Summer of 42. I didn't like it at the time.
I remember my parents liking it. They really thought it was...
I remember sort of enjoying it when it first came out, and I saw it on TV like years later, and was like, this really isn't very good.
No. and that goopy score.
Yeah,
did win the Oscar for Michelle LeGrand.
But again, proof of our point that time is the answer to everything. That if you had asked people in 71, I'm sure they would have thought, people would be watching Summer 42 50 years from now.
Turner has it occasionally, but it's like it. Norman Jewison, Canadian film producer and director. Many of his films address social issues. He worked extensively in Canadian television before landing at CBS, where he directed specials for Danny Kaye, Judy Garland, and Harry Belafonte. His first feature film as a director was 40 Pounds of Trouble with Tony Curtis. He also directed two Doris Day movies, The Thrill of It All with James Garner and Send Me No Flowers with Rock Hudson. But his breakthrough film as a director was The Cincinnati Kid, which starred Steve McQueen and Edward G. Robinson, and he was a last-minute replacement for Sam Peckinpah, who was fired 3 days into the shoot, which we did not know.
Surprise.
His next film that he produced and directed was the comedy The Russians Are Coming, which was nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including a Best Picture nomination for Jewison, but not a directing nomination. The following year, he directed In the Heat of the Night for Walter Mirisch and received his first of 3 directing nominations. The film, a murder mystery in rural Mississippi that dealt with racial issues, won 5 Oscars, including Best Picture, but was overlooked Jewison for Best Director. Mike Nichols won for The Graduate. His next two films were The Thomas Crown Affair and Gaily Gaily, both successful. Then he moved to Europe, where he was offered the chance to produce and direct the film version of Fiddler on the Roof. Jewison claims he was offered the chance to direct it because the executives of United Artists mistakenly thought he was Jewish.
He put the Jew in Jewison.
The film was a huge hit and won it Oscar nominations for Best Picture and Director. 2 years later, he filmed another musical, Jesus Christ Superstar, which was also successful. He continued producing and directing films in the 1970s and 1980s, including Rollerball, Fist, F-I-S-T, with Sylvester Stallone, and Justice for All, Best Friends, A Soldier's Story, receiving another Oscar nomination for Best Picture.
That's a career.
Agnes of God, and in 1987, produced and directed what many film critics consider his best film, and I definitely do, Moonstruck.
I knew she was sick. I didn't know she was going to die.
It was nominated for 7 Academy Awards and won 3 for Best Actress Cher, Best Supporting Actress Olympia Dukakis, and Original Screenplay. Juicin was nominated for Best Picture, Producer, and Director, but lost both to Bernardo Bertolucci's The Last Emperor. He continued producing and directing in the 1990s and early 2000s, including Other People's Money, In Country, and The Hurricane. He was scheduled to direct Malcolm X, but came under fire from black directors who thought that a black director should direct the film. Spike Lee eventually did direct it. Juicin also produced films directed by others, most notably in one of my favorites, The Landlord.
The Hal Ashby.
Which marked the directorial debut of Hal Ashby, who had won an Oscar editing In the Heat of the Night. Juicin founded the Canadian Film Center, a film school and institution in Toronto, and received the Irving Thalberg Memorial Award at the 1999 Oscars for his body of work. He said at that occasion, "For me, films are about ideas. Every director should ask himself, why am I making the picture? And if you can't answer that, you shouldn't make it."
He had such a head for knowing.
Yeah. Okay. Glennis Johns.
Wow.
100. British stage, TV, and film actress. The daughter of character actor Mervyn Johns, best known for playing Bob Cratchit in the Alistair Sim film of A Christmas Carol. She appeared professionally on the London stage from the time she was 11 in Lillian Hellman's The Children's Hour. She made her film debut in 1938 playing Ralph Richardson's daughter in South Riding. Among her early British films were 49th Parallel, An Ideal Husband, and Miranda, where she played a mermaid who wanted to see London. Her American film debut was in 1951, where she played opposite James Stewart and Marlene Dietrich in No Highway in the Sky. In the 1950s, she was featured in 2 Disney films, The Sword and the Rose and Rob Roy. She continued to work in films in both London and Hollywood, including The Court Jester with Danny Kaye, Papa's Delicate Condition with Jackie Gleason, The Chapman Report, and received an Academy Award nomination in Fred Zimmerman's The Sundowners, where she played a rather loquacious Australian innkeeper. It was for supporting actress. Her most famous film was a 1964 film version of Mary Poppins as Mrs. Banks. Little trivia. When Walt Disney asked her to appear in the film, she thought it was for the title role. Disney promised her top billing and instructed the Sherman Brothers to write her a solo song, Sister Suffragette. Because I remember, even as a 9-year-old, thinking I knew who she was.
Yeah.
But it's for someone who had equal billing with everyone else, it's a relatively small part.
Yes.
You take that song out, she's hardly in it.
Yeah.
And around this time, she also appeared in the CBS sitcom Glennis, playing a mystery writer getting into tough situations. This was sort of a murder she wrote for laughs. I liked it, but I was 8. What did I know?
I remember that show.
Well, they took you to see the birds.
Yeah, well, it only ran 1 season. She continued working on TV and supporting roles in films, but her major accomplishment was on stage, winning a Tony Award for Best Actress in Stephen Sondheim's A Little Night Music. Sondheim wrote the song Sending the Clowns, especially for Johnson, and she was wonderful in that. In the 80s and 90s, she continued working occasionally in film and TV, such as in The Ref, where she played Kevin Spacey's Mother from Hell, opposite Sandra Bullock in While You Were Sleeping, and playing Molly Shannon's grandmother in Superstar in 1999. It's her final film appearance.
Yep.
Okay. Don Murray, 94. Film, TV, and stage actor, known for taking controversial roles. Murray was a church-going pacifist who became a conscientious objector during the Korean War. He fulfilled his service obligation by working for 2.5 years in German and Italian refugee camps for $10 a month, assisting orphans, the injured, and the displaced. When he returned to the U.S., he acted on Broadway in The Rose Tattoo and in the juvenile role in a revival of Thornton Wilder's The Skin of Our Teeth. The director, Josh Logan, saw that production and cast him in the male lead in the film version of William Inge's Bus Stop, opposite Marilyn Monroe. This won Murray an Oscar nomination for his film debut, although it was for a supporting nomination, yeah. And he was the lead. I thought that was kind of, they do that sometimes. That was kind of odd. Other films included A Drug Addict in A Hatful of Rain, Shake Hands with the Devil about the 1921 Irish Rebellion, co-starring Glennis Johns.
Hey.
James Cagney is the lead now.
Cagney, yes. James Cagney. And The Hoodlum Priest, which Murray co-wrote the screenplay. It dealt with a Jesuit who counsels former convicts. One of his most famous film roles was in Otto Preminger's Advice and Consent, where he played a married, closeted U.S. senator being blackmailed by political enemies. And I think that was the first American film that ever dealt with a homosexual character. I can't think of one
openly.
After that, leading man film roles dwindled, but in 1970 he directed and co-wrote The Cross and the Switchblade, which co-starred Pat Boone as a street minister who brings two city street gangs to Christ, a character based on an actual New York preacher, which actually was a pretty good film.
Hmm.
For 3 years, he was on the CBS primetime soap opera Knots Landing and appeared in supporting roles in Endless Love, as Bette Midler called the Endless Movie, License to Kill, and Internet Love. He retired in 2001, but returned to television in 2017 in Twin Peaks, The Return, playing Bushnell Mullins, a Los Angeles insurance man inspired by his work with post-war, as a Las Vegas insurance man. Inspired by his work with post-war refugees in barbed and wired camps in Italy, he and his first wife, the actress Hope Lang, founded the Homeless European Land Program and bought 150 acres on the island of Sardinia in 1956. When financial aid from international agencies and Protestant charities, they brought more than 100 refugees out of Italian camps, people from communist countries in Europe and Franco Spain, to Sardinia, to settle in what became a permanent self-supporting community. Mm. I knew nothing about it.
No, I just
figured his film career fizzled because he played that gay character in Advice and Consent.
Not that simple.
But apparently he chose that.
No, well, Preminger always a little bit ahead of the curve.
But Don Murray chose these roles. He didn't want to get a contract with 20th Century Fox, which was offered to him, because he didn't want to do junk.
It's still a few like that.
He had a period where he was much in demand.
Yeah, in the 50s and early 60s. Yeah. And then after Advice and Consent, he kind of... He did work, but mostly on TV.
He's a good actor.
And my last one, Carl Weathers.
Former
linebacker for the Oakland Raiders, he considered acting his first love, performing in plays in grade school. But he played football in high school while he was getting his theater arts degree. And while getting his theater arts degree in San Diego State University, he played under future NFL fame coach Don Correll. He missed much of the 1969 season with a knee injury, but wound up playing linebacker for the Oakland Raiders. He was considered too small for a linebacker, and it was thought that if he were playing today, he would be a safety. In 1970, he played 7 games for Oakland, but in the following year was told by his coach, John Madden, that he was being cut from the roster. "You're just too sensitive," he was told. After that, he was making TV guest appearances in shows such as Good Times, Kung Fu, and The $6 Million Man. But, of course, his big break was as Apollo Creed in Rocky. But it was a difficult audition. When he read for the part, he read with the screenwriter. Afterwards, he felt uncomfortable and blurted out, I could do a lot better if you got me a real actor to work with. Well, for those who know, the screenwriter was Sylvester Stallone. But apparently he appreciated his Apollo Creed, like fire. So he appeared in Rocky, Rocky II, Rocky III, Rocky IV. He was killed off in that
one. Yeah, Drago killed him. Unbelievable.
But he continued to work in such films as Force 10 Navarone, Predator, Action Jackson, and Happy Gilmore among his 80 films and TV credits.
Wow.
He appeared as himself as an acting coach in Arrested Development.
Yeah. So there we have a lot of other people we have lost along the way, but we will get to all of them. And that was nicely done, Michael. Thank you. So now we move to America's single favorite section. That would be John Meyer's legendary quote quiz. And are we doing the prize giveaway? We should totally do the prize giveaway.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, all right. So whoever gets this one right first gets a vintage Sand t-shirt. Oh, wow. What? Yes. And you thought you were sitting here for nothing. Come on now.
Okay,
all
so.
All right, John, hit it.
Last episode's quote was, "Not all who wander are aimless, especially not those who seek truth beyond tradition, beyond definition, beyond the image." That was Kirsten Dunst in Mona Lisa Smile, 2003, directed by Mike Newell. I don't know if anybody ever got that one.
That was reasonably obscure.
Yes. Okay. And the new quote is,
drumroll,
"If we've been telling lies, you've been telling half lies. A man who tells lies, like me, merely hides the truth. But a man who tells half lies has forgotten where he put it."
Ooh.
Anyone?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't even think I remember that one.
I have a bonus quote if no one can get this one. Should I read the next one? No one knows it.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay.
Well, all right. Well, tell us what it is first.
Oh. It's it's from Lawrence of Arabia. Claude Rains speaking to Peter O'Toole. Okay, so the other quote is, "Yeah, I left it noisy. That way it scares away any pain in the ass innocent bystanders away."
You go for it.
Go for it.
It's the Godfather.
Yeah.
Yes! That young man t-shirt. Yes! All right. Got to get your size. We're ordering them specials. So there you go. All right. So that brings us roughly to the end where we normally end, but we have a few minutes for questions if anybody has any general film questions or, you know, haven't heard enough of our opinions over the last hour and change, which I'm sure you all have. Any questions from the crowd? There we go. Brave soul.
So I just found out that Dune is based on a book and David Lynch had a really, like, weird, bad, but so bad it's good version of Dune in the 80s. What do you think about
it? It is true.
I walked out after an hour and a half. I thought to myself, I have no idea what's going on.
Here's the thing, though. Lynch had made Eraserhead and The Elephant Man, and for some reason, Dino De Laurentiis got it into his head that he wanted this guy who'd done these tiny little black and white films to direct this huge epic scale, you know, big worms and everything kind of film. And Lynch was very smart. Lynch said, "I will do this, but I have this script that I've been writing, and if you will finance my script, I will direct Dune." Yeah, the 84 Dune is terrible, but so bad that it's good. But the film that Lynch got to make because of his direct was Blue Velvet. And so we have Blue Velvet because of Dune. So for that reason, we loved. Thank you, Dune. Exactly. And by the way, speaking of Dune, when is someone going to give Denis Villeneuve, an Oscar nomination? I know they hate science fiction.
Well, they nominated him for Dune 1.
Didn't they nominate him? No, they didn't. And,
yeah,
you know, the whole thing about being a director is creating a world, building a world, and that's what he did in Dune, based on Herbert's novel, but...
I liked Arrival a lot.
I loved Arrival. I really loved Blade Runner 2049. I loved Sicario. I like everything he's done. He's just one of our best directors and completely ignored because he's working in a genre that is considered lesser somehow. Maybe that will change. Any other questions? Good question. Thank you. Da, 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 da. I'm allowed to sing that because I was on Jeopardy once. Na, 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 yeah, all rights reserved. No, 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 no. Nope.
No,
nope.
That's not.
All right. Okay.
People
so.
Want to go home.
We're looking forward
no, it's
to
Saturday night. Yeah,
for
exactly.
suggestions for our
well,
for future
isn't
episodes.
That what
we can't wait to see. Yep. We can't
yeah.
wait to see what your suggestions are, and as we begin our next 50 episodes. And I will end by saying that, you know, we're talking before about the death of cinema. And people have been talking about the death of cinema since sound came in 1929. So I'm not too worried about the death of cinema. In fact, I'm excited about the possibilities of what may come next. Maybe they will listen to Corey Jefferson, and instead of making The Flash for $300 million, they'll make 10 good $30 million films. That would be lovely. Who you never know when the next revolution is coming. But if you are in a nostalgic mood, Mike lives right near the Paris up on 58th. The Paris is the last single theater movie theater. In Manhattan anyway, which is so beyond lovely, they are doing a retrospective of 1974 films for the 50th anniversary. Not Godfather 2, but everything else.
Chinatown.
From Chinatown to Foxy Brown, and I'm going to be there for Foxy Brown, no doubt, to see Pam Grier on a big screen. And so that's that. We're looking forward
the
to
woman
that.
Woman Under the Influence, which rarely shows.
Woman
why,
Under the Influence.
Why are they showing Godfather 2?
I don't know. Maybe
they probably couldn't get the rights to
it.
Or,
yeah.
Yep. And Badlands, which I've Terry Malick's Badlands, which I've never seen on a big screen.
I still think it's 1973.
I know, me too. What are you going to do? So there's that. So, as we end every episode by saying this is a 5 9s and a 4 production. Should we finally explain that?
Yes.
Okay, we'll finally explain it. We all met working at the R.R. Bowker Publishing Company. Do you guys remember Bowker, those big books in print things that used to have in bookstores? Those huge volumes called Books in Print? We did that. And we did the subject guide to Books in Print. So they would send us lists of titles, publishing houses, and we got to play Jeopardy all day and figure out what categories to put them into. It's like my dream job, even though we paid, what, $14,000?
Yeah.
Yeah, in 1987. So, yeah. So, live in large. So,
the overtime king.
Oh, that's right. I did
and,
a lot of
and they would give us a lot of overtime, and once in a while, you'd get a huge list of trade paperbacks that were all like trade fiction, airport fiction, and they had all had the same code, which was 0999994. So, and that was like easy money. So you do like dash off 200 of those and you get paid like, you know, per 20. So that was our big overtime. So that's where 5 9s and a 4 comes from. It's the easy
it's
money.
A real inside
it's
joke.
It's a real inside joke. So there you go. And yet here we are still 40 years
right.
later. So there you go. We are want to thank Melissa for her technical help as always. And And Mama Sue for her original letting us use the hall. Thank you, Mama Sue. Yeah. And Theo for the amazing Kick-Ass logo, which we love and we love them. So you tell Theo that their logo is freaking amazing. All right. Remember that we are available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and SoundCloud. We're thinking about YouTube, but that's a little complicated, but that's next steps. Please check out the website, www.vintagesand.com, to get more information on our episodes and what we've talked about before. We wish you all a safe and happy spring. It's spring. It's rebirth. So thank you guys so much for
thank
coming
for
and being
coming.
A part of this. And
yeah.
give yourself and we
thank
give,
you for listening.
Yeah. And we give you our final benediction, as always. May your favorite films always be streaming.